Senator Lisa Murkowski considers her options 1 week after conceding the GOP primary. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 7th of September. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Southeast law enforcement community rallies around Huna as the town prepares for a memorial for the police officers who died.
I didn't personally know the two officers that were slain. But the law enforcement family is a pretty small, tight-knit community, you know, throughout the region.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A week after conceding the GOP primary, Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's not a quitter and is, quote, still in this game. Murkowski told the Associated Press today that she's been inundated with calls and emails from supporters asking her not to leave the race. She says she's been humbled and is listening and weighing her options. She said, quote, what I'm looking at is my state and the future of my state for my kids. So I have not made that determination that I'm going to give up. I'm not a quitter, never have been, and I'm still in this game, unquote. Murkowski met briefly today with the Libertarian candidate David Hassey after friends of hers, without her direction, she said, approached his party asking if they would consider a Murkowski candidacy. She said she had an interesting discussion with Hassey, but made clear she's not interested in changing her political stripes. Besides a third-party run, Murkowski also could seek a write-in candidacy, which she called high risk, or she could decide to stay out of the race. She gave no timetable for a decision, and her fate as a Libertarian candidate lies with party leaders who earlier voted against putting her on the ballot. A party's candidate would have to withdraw by September 15th so someone else could run in the November election. She has until 5 days before the general election to decide on a write-in run, but acknowledged a decision needs to be made soon. Murkowski said she's listening to Alaskans and giving, quote, considered thought. The tiny southeast village of Huna has received condolences from around the world for the recent shooting deaths of police officers Tony Wallace and Matt Tokioka. The pair were ambushed by a lone gunman August 29th as they chatted with each other and their families on the town's front street. John Marvin Jr. has been charged with their murders and is currently being held at Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau on $1 million bail. Hundreds plan to attend a memorial service for Wallace and Tokioka tomorrow in Huna. Among the mourners will be dozens of police officers from Alaska and the rest of the country. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, the law enforcement community has rallied around the town in the days since the shooting.
Assistant Juneau Police Chief Paige Decker was enjoying a quiet Saturday night at home when he got word that officers were down in Huna. Decker had to quickly decide how many police officers he could spare.
I had to go through that process and determine, you know, what our resources were and what we felt we could let go for a short period of time over there. They certainly needed help, and so we're going to do what we can.
The suspect, John Marvin Jr., was barricaded inside his home. Decker put together a team of 12 officers, including Juneau's SWAT team, hostage negotiators, and a bomb squad. Then he turned his attention to getting the officers to Huna, 40 air miles away. The Coast Guard offered a patrol boat.
It's hard to just pick up in the middle of the night and find transportation for a team, and it's either going to be by air or water. Thank goodness that the Coast Guard was able to do that for us.
Sergeant David Campbell, a hostage negotiator and 15-year veteran of the Juneau Police Department, was among those tapped to go to Huna. Using a bullhorn, Campbell attempted to communicate with Marvin, who remained in his home for a day and a half.
I just explained to him who I was, why I was there, explained the situation to him that, the place was surrounded and I wanted him to come out and give up peacefully without anybody getting hurt.
Besides JPD and state troopers, the initial response included Alaska wildlife troopers, a U.S. Forest Service officer, and police from Sitka, Anchorage, and Wrangell. The Federal Bureau of Investigation was also en route to Hoonah when Marvin surrendered. Campbell says the response was nothing short of amazing. At the same time, he's not surprised so many other agencies were willing to help.
Southeast Alaska, even though it's geographically spread out and there are no roads, you tend to know law enforcement in other communities. There's a mutual training that goes on. I didn't personally know the two officers that were slain, but the law enforcement family is a pretty small, tight-knit community throughout the region.
In the days after the incident, police departments from other communities have continued to assist Hoonah. The deaths of Tony Wallace and Matt Tokioka left the Hoonah Police Department with just one full-time police officer, Chief John Milan, as well as an officer in training. Departments in Wrangell, Yakutat, Sitka, and Ketchikan have offered short-term help while Hoonah seeks new officers. Wrangell Police Chief Doug McCloskey says it's the least he can do.
It creates some overtime issues for us. But when you work amongst these small communities like all of us are, when you have that kind of a crime scene, without the officers having been involved, could easily overpower most of our departments. Add the loss of the two officers to it, they would desperately need help, any of us would.
A United States honor flag arrived in Alaska last week to be displayed at memorial services for the fallen officers. The flag flew 9 years ago at Ground Zero in New York City after the September 11th attacks and now travels around the country to honor fallen police and firefighters. More than 75 Alaska police, fire, and military officials took part in a ceremony Friday in Anchorage honoring Wallace and Tokioka. Alaska State Troopers and Juneau Police will lead a funeral procession through the capital city tomorrow morning as the officers' remains are taken to the state ferry Malaspina for transport to Hoonah. Officers from across the country and Canada are expected to attend a memorial service in Hoonah tomorrow afternoon. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Geologists will get an underground look at a suspected fault this week as part of a state-led reconnaissance of the route of a gas pipeline to Canada. State neotectonic geologist Rich Kaler says the excavation project near Cathedral Rapids on the Tanana River west of Choke allows investigators to peer back in geologic time.
To learn about the paleoseismic history, old earthquakes. So we'll be digging a trench to look for evidence of offset layers, and then make attempts to date those layers with radiocarbon to figure out how often earthquakes happen along that particular structure.
Kaler says the fault site is one of many on the north side of the Alaska Range the state is evaluating along the potential gas line route between Delta Junction and the border. He says the process starts with an aerial recon.
We take GPS points from the helicopter, and then we just look for signs indicative of active faulting. Slope might be coming down with a gentle slope, and then all of a sudden it drops off rather steeply, and that feature will be continuous for hundreds of meters.
Kaler says the area has a lot of low-level seismic activity, and that trenching done by the state on other fault sites to the east and west shows evidence of earthquakes as long ago as 10,000 years. He says the data derived from fault excavations will be used by gas line engineers.
The geologists really, and our maps really provide them with the angle that the fault may cross the pipeline and what type of events, whether it be thrust where one side goes up relative to the other side or side-by-side motion or strike slip. We tell them the direction that it can occur and kind of the relative amount of offset they might expect. And they take that information and they use that in their engineering designs.
Excavation is scheduled to begin tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the epic Wrangell Mountain ski adventure continues.
It was kind of a thrill to know that we were sharing the glacier with Mother Grizzly and her two cubs. I just hope they don't find our tent tonight.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
It's an annual phenomena as regular as turning leaves and snow lines descending from the mountaintops, the fall and winter flu season. Health professionals are busy preparing for this year's flu outbreaks. At the same time, they're looking for more effective ways to reach Alaska's various ethnic and racial groups. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
When preparing for the upcoming flu season, Dr. Ross Singleton of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium looks at last year's statistics.
Alaska Native people in Anchorage had a hospitalization rate that was four times the rate of the Anchorage white population. Another ethnic minority that was affected was Pacific Islanders, who had a hospitalization rate that was nearly three to four times the white population.
Singleton was one of the medical professionals attending an ethnic media roundtable held this morning at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. The first goal was to update the press on this fall's vaccine availability and distribution. The second was to get ideas from the ethnic media members on how better to tell minority groups about the vaccinations.
Right now, beginning this year, the influenza vaccine is recommended for all persons age 6 months and older.
Dr. Jay Butler is currently with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Prior to that, he was at the Centers for Disease Control and is a former commissioner of the state's Health and Social Services Department. Butler said this year's flu shot will contain the H1N1 swine flu vaccine, plus two others, including one for the more traditional varieties that strike older people. Last year's H1N1 outbreak was distinctive because it struck younger, healthier people. About 10,000 died nationwide from H1N1 in 2009. About 1,000 of them were children. Last year's H1N1 vaccination campaign ran into supply problems, with scheduled clinics postponed or closing early due to a lack of vaccine. Jerry Yett, Deputy Immunization Program Manager for the state of Alaska, does not foresee those situations occurring this year.
In the spring of this year, we procured approximately 90,000 doses of vaccine to be distributed this year. We're going to distribute that into two categories. Approximately 61,000 of that will go for children for the ages of 6 months through 18 years. Then about 29,000 doses will be for the adult population.
Those numbers do not include doses ordered by private medical clinics and pharmacies in Alaska. Singleton notes that last year the vaccine was attacked by several email rumors. She mentioned the most common.
The swine vaccine contains a computer chip. The swine vaccine was untested and targeted indigenous people. That the H1N1 vaccine contains dangerous additives.
Singleton says such misinformation can keep people from getting the vaccine. Some members of Anchorage's ethnic press, like Catherine Forrest of Latinos in Alaska, said those rumors also circulated through the Latino community. Forrest felt last year's campaign was not very effective at getting the vaccination message out to non-English speakers.
Another parent who is very limited in the English spoken language doesn't understand the newsletter getting vaccinated. She has a five-year-old trying to translate what's going to happen if she doesn't understand the consent form.
Forrest said recent immigrants can also be suspicious of government agencies in general. Lucy Hansen, founder of Pacific News in Alaska, said the health agency should make more use of ethnic churches, not only to spread information, but to administer the vaccine. Yet says the state hopes to begin its distribution by September 13th with actual clinics scheduled later. Doses are available already at some private facilities. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The opening of the state's newest sportfish hatchery in Fairbanks has again been postponed. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Problems with the water treatment system at the Ruth Burnett Sport Fish Hatchery has again pushed back the opening date to later this month at the earliest. But Jeff Milton, the state's hatchery program supervisor, says that delay won't set back the overall schedule for making rainbow trout available to stock in lakes around the interior beginning next spring.
The production schedule, yes, as far as producing catchable rainbow trout and having those available next spring is the primary goal, and we're still on schedule for that.
The problem is adjusting the water treatment system at the hatchery to bring down the level of iron and manganese enough to enable fish to thrive. Milton says the system performed pretty well in tests recently, but not when the water flow was increased.
As we ramped it up to the higher end of our production usage, it was starting to perform somewhat erratically, and so that's why we haven't moved fish in there. We can't, we don't feel comfortable moving fish in until we have real stable performance.
When the water treatment system is performing adequately, Milton says the trout fingerlings that have been incubated in a hatchery at Fort Richardson will be brought here. Rainbow trout will be the main species to be grown at the Burnett Hatchery. The $46 million hatchery also will produce Arctic char, Arctic grayling, lake trout, Chinook salmon, and coho salmon. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Although fall is in the air, we can still plan ahead for next year's vegetable patch. A new gardening manual written specifically for Alaska has been published by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Sustainable Gardening, the Alaska Master Gardener Manual, is 490 pages long and is in some respects the brainchild of Cooperative Extension Service agent Michelle Hebert, who works in Fairbanks. She says the new manual was adapted for Alaska from an Oregon State University publication.
I actually got a copy of that and said, wow, this is really good information, but it's not quite as good as it could be if we Alaskanized it.
The new gardening manual includes information on soils and fertilizers, berry crops, composting, greenhouses, and pest management. Hebert says the basic manual from Oregon State University had to be tweaked to take into account the differences between the Pacific Northwest and Alaska.
We actually had to think about the coal soils, the shorter growing season, and things like day length, because actually our long day length causes increased bolting in a lot of different types of vegetable crops.
The new manual is titled Sustainable Gardening, which Hebert says encompasses different techniques than standard gardening.
I almost think, depending on your age, sustainable gardening is maybe gardening how your grandparents did it. They weren't using as many chemical fertilizers or pesticides because we had lots of small farms with manure and people were using resources that were local and readily available without paying money. So I think there's a movement to go back to that.
While Hebert contributed to the new gardening manual, she got a lot of help from Alaska Cooperative Extension faculty from across the state, and Hebert says that wealth of information makes the manual appropriate for use by gardeners from all areas of Alaska.
When we were designing this manual, we used our statewide extension staff, all the way from our agents in Juneau and Sitka and in Anchorage and in Fairbanks and Kenai, and we all pulled together. So we tried to present a manual that would fit the needs of our state. Now, of course, that's harder than in most states because we have such diversity, but we did our best, and we think it is a good manual. It presents good science, and if people pay attention to that science and the principles and the information we're provided and gather those tools for decision-making, we think they'll be able to do well in their area.
You can order a copy on the Cooperative Extension Service website in Dillingham. I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
And now back to the Wrangell Mountains, where Anchorage-based mountain guide Joe Stock is halfway through a long ski tour with two friends. They set off into the Wrangells with little information, craving adventure. In last night's story, they reached a point high in the mountains and became stalled by avalanche and crevasse conditions.
We'd reached a major decision point. Keep battling the incessant crevasses and avalanche-prone snowpack, or look for a fast route out of the mountains. We studied the maps for a safe route to continue our trip through the Wrangells. We found none.
And on top of that, a lot of the faces we're looking at on the mountains aren't even covered with enough snow to be skiing. They're just mainly icy. And in addition to that, there's avalanches happening and unstable snow and all that. So it's just not the right time to be skiing here, I guess.
We agreed to bail towards McCarthy. From the map, the route appeared to be 25 miles of skiing down the Nazina Glacier, then a 30-mile walk along the Nazina River to McCarthy. The problem is that maps are just paper. Reality is always different. We had no idea what to expect. The adventure was still on. All the next day, we skied down the Nazina Glacier. Dylan fulfilled a dream he'd had on over 20 Alaska expeditions.
I have always wanted to see a bear in Alaska, and today I saw three dots, two little ones and one bigger one, and that was through my spotting scope. And it was kind of a thrill to know that we were sharing the glacier with Mother Grizzly and her two cubs. I just hope they don't find our tent tonight.
That night we camped on a ridge of boulders on the vast Nazina Glacier. We came prepared for a nighttime visit from bears.
Well, standard way to defend yourself from a bear would be a gun or an electric fence or something expensive like that, but we took a more creative approach and bought some fireworks. The fireworks stand on the way up here.
Let's get the bang candle.
Hey, is it this way or this way?
Black cap banger candles. Explosion with report. That night at camp, we balanced ice axes and cook pots on top of the food bags. We hoped that a marauding beast snooping in our food would clatter the metal, wake us up, and we'd shoo the animal away. But the animals never showed up. On day 6, we continued skiing down the Nazina Glacier. At lower elevations, the snow had melted, leaving bare glacier ice. We kept skiing anyway. The end of the Nazina Glacier was barred by a huge frozen lake with immense icebergs. Our 1993 map showed no signs of this lake. The glacier was receding like most in Alaska. We skated across the lake ice. Danny describes what we saw next.
And then you pull over the top of this moraine, and all of a sudden stretched out in front of us was just miles of basically dead flat floodplain with these tiny little trees sticking out. It was pretty trippy.
We stumbled down the floodplain for 5 hours, carrying skis on dry ground, absorbed in the colossal limestone walls that looked more like the Canadian Rockies than anything we'd seen in Alaska. The next day, we thrashed along the river for 14 hours. When the Nazina River banked hard against the valley walls, we were pushed up into the forest. In the forest, we made constant noise to alert bears.
Back in heaven, the one I love, I don't want none at all. Shady Grove, my little love.
Eventually, we reached a deserted mining road and followed it for 6 miles towards McCarthy. Exhaustion racked us after walking 30 miles in ski boots on riverbed.
Oh, I don't know. Everything from my knees down is the most painful.
In McCarthy, we cracked beers and laughed with relief.
Oh, you know I smelled that.
Cheers, you guys.
Cheers, cheers.
While we were traveling through harsh terrain, this was a vacation to us. We weren't working, just out having fun exploring the mountains. Even though, as Dylan was quick to point out in the drive home, conditions were horrendous.
So in many ways it was disappointing. We didn't ski down any big peaks. We didn't experience the pleasure of steep powder or anything like that. But in other ways, the trip was quite a blast because we had to figure out how to get out of a place that was a bit unwelcoming to us.
We'll be back again next year, having adventures in another mountainous corner of Alaska. I'm Joe Stock.
If you missed last night's story, check it out at aprn.org. You can also view a slideshow there from the trip. Indigenous elders from around the world are planning a gathering in Alaska to promote respect for the earth and all its inhabitants. Representatives of the Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers came to Anchorage this weekend to make initial preparations. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
A California spiritual leader called Jyoti says she had a vision about a council of elders of indigenous women 9 or 10 years ago. She says Native American spiritual leaders told her about ancient prophecies that grandmothers would lead humanity from the brink of destruction. She invited elders from around the world to a 2004 gathering in the Catskill Mountains in New York, and they organized the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, which is the subject of a documentary shown at fundraising events in Anchorage this weekend.
I am Red Spider Woman.
My name is Cindro Macardon.
Je suis Bernadette Ribino.
I'm Rita Blumenstein, and I don't look like Blumenstein, but I am.
That was Rita Blumenstein, Yupik of Anchorage. Other council members include women from tribes in North and South America, women from Nepal, Gabon, Africa, and India. All are healers or educators. Some have advanced degrees. One is a survivor of political torture. They joined together out of concern for the planet.
Look at the nature, look at the water, look at this air, look at this fire, the sun even. Look at this earth. We are in the 11th hour.
This past weekend, Grandmother Agnes Baker Pilgrim of the Takelma Tribe of Oregon, Jyoti and Blumenstein, showed the documentary about the Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers and spoke at fundraisers at the Anchorage Museum and the Alaska Native Heritage Center. The funds are for a gathering of the grandmothers in Anchorage, scheduled for May or June of 2011. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Len Anderson and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft and airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.